read that easily, those images examined. But he didn't mind. He was too fascinated with this ghost of Magnus. So many questions came to his mind. Can you eat? Can you drink? Can you make love? Can you taste?
No, said Magnus. But I can see very well, and I can feel hot and cold in a pleasurable way, and I have a sense of being here, being alive, occupying this space, being tangible, and having a tempo in time.
Ah, this was Magnus, all right. This was Magnus talking, who could talk the night away with Rosamandes. How Rosamandes had loved him and respected him, throwing a veil of protection about him and forbidding all blood-drinkers to harm him. Even after he'd stolen the blood, Rosamandes had not hunted him down and sought to kill him.
"He has a great fascination for me," Rosamandes had said, "and Benedict is to blame for allowing it to happen. But let's see what he will do with the blood. Poor humpbacked and clever Magnus."
"Be very careful, Everard," said Magnus.
He looked for all the world like a man of 45, or perhaps 50 in these healthy times of plenty and rampant good health, with glowing skin and hair truly the colour of ashes. Why hadn't he made himself flamingly beautiful like the flashy Lestat, with that leonine golden mane and those violet-blue eyes? But as he gazed at Magnus, this seemed a stupid question. This was a splendid being here before him. They were both splendid, these ghosts, and they could change, couldn't they, any time they wanted to.
"Yes, but we try not to do that," said Raymond. "We seek to perfect what we are, not to constantly alter it. We seek to find something that is a true expression of our soul with which to shape what makes up our form. But there's no need for you to trouble yourself over these things."
"Stay safe," said Descarmen. "Be clever. And if this voice provokes a gathering of the tribe, consider coming. We cannot stay the same in these times, because nothing now can stay the same, and we must needs meet the challenges as humans are meeting them."
Descarmen took a small white card out of his pocket and handed it to Everard, a gentleman's calling card. On it was written the name Descarmen, in golden script, and beneath it was an email very simple to memorize, actually, and a phone number.
"We're going now, friend," said Descarmen. "But if you need us, contact us. We wish you luck."
"I think I'll survive this, same way I survived world wars and the earlier massacre, but thank you. And thank you for putting up with my disagreeable behavior."
"It's been a pleasure," said Descarmen. "One last bit of advice. Keep listening to Benji. If there is to be a coming together, Benji will give the word."
Everard shook his head. "A coming together? Like last time? A big showdown to stop the wicked voice the way the wicked queen was stopped? How do you have a showdown with a voice that can pop into the head of anyone at any time, and can hear anything, perhaps, that I'm saying, or even thinking?"
"That's a good question," said Raymond Gallant.
"It all depends, doesn't it, on what the voice really wants."
"And what is that?" said Everard. "Other than to turn us against one another."
The three creatures rose to their feet. Descarmen extended his hand. Everard also rose with obvious respect.
"You make me think of better times, you really do," he murmured in spite of himself.
Suddenly he was furious at himself for becoming so emotional.
"And what times were those?"
asked Descarmen kindly.
"When Rosamandes was still... oh, I don't know. Hundreds of years ago, before the children of Satan destroyed his castle, destroyed everything. That's what happens when blood drinkers unite, band together, believe things. We're evil. We've always been."
The three looked at him calmly, without making the slightest response. Nothing in their expressions or demeanor suggested agreement or evil. "And you have no idea at all where Rosamandes might be, do you?" asked Raymond Gallant.
"None," said Everard.
And then he found himself confessing,
"If I did, why, I'd go to him."
Such strange words coming from him, who had such complete disregard for other blood-drinkers, who scorned covens, havens, vampire hostels and gangs. But he knew he had confessed the truth, that he'd travel the earth to find Rosamandis. Actually, he never travelled anywhere much. But it was good to think he'd travel the earth to find his old master.
"He's long gone, dead, burned up, immolated, whatever," he said sharply. "Has to be."
"You think?" asked Raymond Galland. A sudden pain tugged at Everard's heart.
"He has to be dead, or he would have found me by now, gathered me to him, forgiven me."
Rosamandis had abandoned the wild, thick forests of France and Germany in the 1300s. Weary of battling the ever-increasing children of Satan, who had cannibalized his own fledglings to his eternal misery, he had simply left the ancient battlefield. But Everard had never known the true story. The children of Satan had had Everard by then, dragging him out nightly to scourge the innocent of Paris. They bragged that they'd driven the last great blasphemer from French land. Had they really? Magnus they had not feared as they had Rosamandis. They told tales of Rosamandis's castle and lands, burnt in the daylight hours by rabid monks and nuns, driven to do it by the nightly whispers of children of Satan pretending to be angels. Ah, those times. Those superstitious times when vampires could speak to gullible religious minds and play infernal games with them. "Well, I can tell you this," Everard said, denying the pain. "If he's slumbering underground somewhere under some Merovingian ruin, the voice won't get anywhere with him. No matter what state he's in, he's too wise for that, too powerful. He was magnificent." Sharp, grinding memory. Everard going out in filthy rags with the children of Satan to harry the Parisian poor, slinking into filthy hovels to feed on the innocent, and somewhere near the voice of Rosamandis calling,
"Everard, break free, come back to me."
"Goodbye, Everard," said Tescarman, and the three moved off together.
For a long moment Everard watched them as they walked down the narrow street and disappeared around the corner. Not a single human being would ever guess what they were. Their human poise was simply superb. He leaned his elbow on the table and rested his chin in his hand. Was he glad they were gone? Or was he sorry? Did he want to run after them and say, "Don't leave me here, take me with you, I want to stay with you"? Yes and no. He did want to do that, but he simply could not do it. He didn't know how to do that, how to speak that honestly to them, how to implore them for their help or their companionship. He didn't know how to be anything but what he was. Suddenly the voice was there. He heard it sigh.
"They can't protect you from me," said the voice. "They're devils."
"They didn't seem like devils to me," said Everard testily.
"They and their laughable Talamasca," said the voice. "Be damned!"
"Talamasca," whispered Everard in amazement.
"Of course, Talamasca. That's where I heard that name, Raymond Galland, before. Why, that man was known to Marius. That man
died about 500 years ago." It was amusing to him, suddenly. Very amusing. He'd always known about the Talamasca, the old order of scholars of the supernatural. Rosamandis had warned him about them and their old monastery in southern France. Yet his maker had urged him to respect them and leave them alone. He'd loved them the way he'd loved Magnus.
"For they are gentle scholars," he'd said in that deep, seductive voice of his, "and they mean us no harm."
Ah, but it is astonishing. They know as much of us as the Church of Rome, but they do not condemn us, and they mean us no harm. They want to learn about us. Imagine it. They study us, and when have we ever studied ourselves? I rather like them for that. I do. You must never hurt them. And so their membership included humans and ghosts, did it? And blood drinkers. Raymond Galland, Tescarman, and Magnus. Did all of their human members become ghosts when they died? Well, that would never have worked, surely. There'd be thousands of spectral members floating around by now. That was absurd. No, It was fairly easy to figure that it was a rare occurrence to recruit a dying member from their ranks to remain with them in spirit, simply because it was so very rare for any dying person's spirit to remain behind. Oh, the planet had lots of ghosts, but they were an infinitesimal remnant of all those poor slobs who'd been born and died since the dawn of creation. But how blessed must be the ghosts inducted into the Talamasca with book-educated sorcerers to help them learn to materialize. That's what Magnus had been driving at. No wonder they'd been so good at it, those two, with their warm, ruddy complexions and their shining, moist lips. But the vampire, Tescammon, how in the world did he become part of them? Everard ran a quick scan in his mind of what he'd learned about the Talamasca, from Lestat's writings and Marius's memoir. Dedicated, honourable, committed to truth without religious suspicion, censure, or judgment, yes. If their ranks included vampires, the vast majority of the rank and file certainly had never guessed it. Then there was the great mystery of who had founded the Talamasca. If it turned out to be a vampire, a mere blood drinker such as Tescammon, old as he was, well, that would be a crushing disappointment to the others, wouldn't it? That was their problem. He studied the little white card and put it safely in his jacket.
"Contemptible," said the voice. "In the end I will burn them all as well. I will burn their libraries, their little museums, their retreat houses, their—" "I get it," said Everard angrily. "You will rue the night you mocked me."
"Oh, yeah?" Everard said in a low American drawl. "If you're all that strong voice, why don't you give it a try? They've been around since the Dark Ages, and they don't appear to be afraid of you at all."
"You infuriating, stupid, disrespectful and foolish monster," said the voice. "Your time will come."
Everard was suddenly startled. A waiter stood beside him with a mug of coffee, the steam rising in the cool air.
"Talking to yourself again, Signor de Landen?" he said cheerfully.
Everard smiled, shook his head, and took out a couple of bills of big, pretty Italian currency, and gave them to the young man. Then he sat back and held the warm cup in both hands. Lestat did get that right in the Vampire Chronicles, he thought. It was nice to hold a hot mug of coffee in your two hands, and let the steam rise into your face. The only sounds around him were the predictable voices of the town, a motor scooter firing up somewhere far off, and then belching as it went away into the country, and the low hum of conversations blossoming behind closed doors. He was thirsting. Suddenly he was thirsting, really thirsting, but he hadn't the energy to go far enough away from his home to satisfy his thirst. He left the coffee and got up and made his way through the streets to the city gates. Within moments he'd passed out of the illumination of the high-walled town, and he was walking uphill fast in cool darkness, and he felt like weeping, and he didn't quite know why. Was it conceivable that we are a tribe? Was it conceivable that we were beings who could love one another, be gentle with one another, the way that Tescammon had been with his spectral companions, the way Rosamandes had been with him so very long ago? What if there had never been any children of Satan in his existence, starving and torturing him and teaching him that he was a child of the devil, that he had to be miserable and create misery for others, that he was a damned and loathsome thing? What if there had only been mad Rosamandes in his crumbling old castle, speaking of poetry and power and splendour in the blood? Human beings didn't buy all that old religious rot nowadays, did they? They didn't skulk about under the burden of original sin and concupiscence any more, pleading for absolution for having bedded their wives the night before going to Holy Communion, cursing their anatomy for dooming them to eternal damnation, denouncing themselves as bags of stinking bones and flesh. No, quite the contrary. In this new century, they were filled with hope and a new kind of innocence and strangely confident optimism that they could solve the problems confronting them and cure all illness and feed the entire world, at least so it seemed in this clean and peaceful part of Europe, which in the past had known so much suffering, so much misery, so much bloodshed and meaningless death. What if such a bright and shining time had come for blood drinkers as well, even the most monstrous as Everard had become? His thoughts drifted back in spite of himself to the last brother in the blood he'd loved. Such a fine, spirited young male vampire who, remembering little of his life before the dark gift, had seen life around him as miraculous, whispering of the blood being a sacrament, and singing long, carefree songs of an evening to the moon and the stars. But that one had been burnt to ashes by the great and terrible Queen Akasha when she passed over. Everard had seen that with his own eyes. All that sweet vitality extinguished in an instant, indifferently, as fire engulfed the whole vampire hangout in Venice where so many others had perished as well. Why had Everard survived? He shuddered. He didn't want to think of that. Best never to love another. Best to forget instantly those who winked out as if they'd never existed. Best to live for the pleasures of each night as they came. But what if it were a time now for them all to come together, to be the tribe that Benji believed them to be, to approach others, old and young, without rage or fear? Rochamandes had laughed at the very idea of the children of Satan and their sanctimonious ways. He used to say, "I was in the blood before their god was even born." Everard didn't want to think too much about all that, either. Let it go, and never remember the satanic covens and their sabbats. Forget forever those horrid hymns offered to the Prince of Darkness. Ah, what if it were possible to come together and worship not a Prince of Darkness, but a Prince of Us? He opened his iPhone and tapped the screen for the app that connected him directly to Benji's broadcast. The broadcast should be in full swing now in America, 2 hours before dawn. He was dozing in his favourite leather chair, half dreaming. Benji was still talking very low through the Bose speaker dock in which Everard had deposited his iPhone, but he was not hearing this. The dream. Back in Rochamandes' castle, in that big hollow hall with a fire blazing, and Benedict, handsome Benedict, with the pretty face, begging to make a vampire of the monk known as Notke the Wise, a creature of immense talent who wrote music night and day as one possessed, songs, motets, chants, and canticles. And Rochamandes considering it, nodding and moving his chess pieces about and saying, "Why do you blood drinkers brought over from the Christian god? I simply do not know." "Oh, but Master, the only god Notke worships is music. Master, would that he could play his music forever." "Shave off that monkly crown of hair from him first," Rochamandes had said, "and then you bring him over. Your blood, not my blood. But I will not have a tonsured blood drinker." Benedict laughed. It was no secret that Rochamandes had locked Benedict up for months to allow his monkly hair to grow back all over his pretty head before he'd given him the dark blood, and Benedict had prepared for the dark gift as if it were a sacrament. Rochamandes demanded beauty in his fledglings. Notke the Wise of Prum was famously beautiful. A noise awakened Everard. It drew him abruptly back from that familiar old hall with its soaring beams and stone pavers. He heard the sharp strike of a match, flare of flames against his eyelids. There were no matches in this house. He used the fire gift to light his fires. He shot out of the leather easy chair and found himself facing two wild-eyed and dishevelled young blood drinkers, a male and a female in the typical vagabond dress of denim and leather. They were setting fire to the draperies in this room.
"Burn, you devil! Burn!"
shouted the male in Italian. With a roar, Everard hurled the female through the window, shattering the glass, and yanked down the burning drapery and threw it over the male as he dragged him roughly through the opening and out into the dark garden. Both were cursing and snarling at him. The male rolled out from under the heap of smouldering velvet with a knife in his hand and ran at Everard.
"Burn!"
Everard collected the fire gift with all his strength in the center of his forehead, then sent the blast against the fool. Flames shot up out of the boy's body, enveloping his arms and head, and his gasping screams were silenced by the roar of the blaze, the blood burning as if it were petrol. The female had fled. But Everard caught her as she mounted the wall, dragging her backwards as he sank his fangs into her throat. She screamed as he tore open the artery, the blood squirting into his mouth against the back of his mouth, inundating his tongue. At once, the flood of images drugged him, her pounding heart driving them as it drove the blood.
The voice, yes, the voice telling her to kill, telling them both to kill, lovers made in a filthy back alley in Milan, by a scrawny bearded blood drinker who pushed them out to kill and steal, 20 years in the blood, maybe, dying, and then it broke down into bits and pieces of childhood, her white first communion dress, incense, the crowded cathedral, Ave Maria, a mother's smiling face, a dress of checkered cloth, apples on a plate, a taste of apples, the inevitable peace. He drank deeper, drawing every last drop he could, from her on, till there was nothing, and the heart had stopped gasping like an open-mouthed fish. From the garden shed he took a spade, and chopped her head from her body. Then he slurped what blood now oozed from the torn neck tissues, the emptying vessels, shimmer of consciousness. Ghastly. He dropped her head and brushed his hands clean. With a gentle blast of the fire gift, he incinerated her remains. The sightless, staring head with the long, straggly locks of black hair caught in her white teeth, the limp body. The smoke died away. The soft breeze of early fall caressed him and comforted him. The silent garden glittered with fragments of broken glass on the tender grass. The blood had cleared his head, sharpened his vision, warmed him, and made the dark morning miraculous. Like jewels, this broken glass, like stars. He breathed in the scent of the lemon trees. All the night was empty around him, no dirges to be sung for this anonymous pair, these beings who might have survived for 1,000 years, if only they had not pitted themselves against one they could not hope to vanquish. "Ah, so voice," Everard said with contempt. "You won't leave me alone, will you? You haven't hurt me, you contemptible monster. You sent these two to their deaths." But there was no answer. With the spade he buried the pair, carefully smoothing down the earth, scraping the clods off the stepping stones off the path. He was shaken. He was disgusted. But one thing was certain. His gift for making fire was now stronger than ever. He had never actually ever used it against another blood drinker, but this had taught him what he could do if he had to do it. Small consolation. Then the voice sighed. Ah, such a sigh. "That was my intention, Everard," said the voice. "I told you I wanted you to kill them, the riffraff. And now you have made a start." Everard made no reply. He leaned on the handle of the spade and thought. The voice had gone. Quiet, the sleeping countryside. Not so much as a car moving on a country road. Only this clean breeze and the glistening leaves of the fruit trees around him, and the white calla lilies glowing against the walls of the villa, the walls of the garden. Fragrance of lilies. Miracle of lilies. Across the sea, Benji Mahmoud was still talking. His voice suddenly drove a sword through Everard's heart. "Elders of the tribe," Benji was appealing, "we need you. Come back to us. Come back to your lost children. Hear my cry on high, a mourning and a bitter weeping. I am Benji, weeping for my lost brothers and sisters, because they are no more." 11. Grimt Stryker Knowles. It was an old colonial mansion, red with white trim, a sprawling building with deep verandas and peaked roofs, covered with soft, fluttering green vines, and invisible from the winding road on account of the massive bamboo and mango trees surrounding it. A lovely place, with palms swaying ever so gracefully in the breeze. It appeared abandoned, but it had never been. Mortal servants maintained it by day. And this vampire Arjun had been sleeping beneath it for centuries. Now he was weeping. He sat at the table, his face in his hands. "In my time, I was a prince," he said. He wasn't boasting. He was merely reflecting. "And among the undead, I was a prince for so long. I do not know how it came to this." "I know all this is true," Grant said.
The blood drinker was undeniably beautiful, with light golden brown skin so flawless it appeared unreal now, and large, fierce black eyes. He had a wealth of jet-black hair worthy of a lion, made by the wandering blood drinker Pandora. In the days of the Kola dynasty of southern India, he had indeed been a prince, and much darker of skin than he was now, and just as comely. The blood had lightened his skin, but not his hair, which was sometimes the case, though no one knew why.
"I have always known who you were," said Grant. "I knew you when you travelled Europe with Pandora. I beg you, for both of us, tell me simply in your own words what happened."
He withdrew a small white visiting card from his pocket, on which was written his full name in golden script, Grempt Stryker Knowles. Beneath it was his email address and the numbers of his mobile phone. But this blood drinker didn't even acknowledge this human gesture. He could not. And Grempt moved the card discreetly to the centre of the teak table and put it halfway under the brass base of a small shaded candle that was flickering there, giving a little bit of light to their faces. A soft golden light also came from the open doors along this deep porch. This was a beautiful place. It touched Grempt that this battered soul, this creature in such distress, had taken such time to wash the dirt from his shining hair, and that he was clothed now in a long, well-fitted and richly jewelled shawani, and black silk pants, and that his hands were clean and scented with true sandalwood.
"But how could you have known me then?"
asked the blood-drinker in a plaintive voice.
"What are you? You're not human, I know this. You are not human, and you are not what I am. What are you?"
"I am your friend now," said Grempt. "I've always been your friend. I've been watching you for centuries, not just you, but all of you."
Arjun was suspicious, of course, but more than anything he was horrified by what he'd done, and he was warming piteously to Grempt's persuasive tone, to the warmth of Grempt's hand on his.
"All I wanted was to sleep," Arjun said.
He spoke with the same accent that was familiar in Goa and India to this day, though his command of English was perfect.
"I knew I would return. My beloved Pandora, she knows that I am here. She's always known. I was safe here when the Queen Akasha went on her rampage. She didn't find me beneath this house."
"I understand," said Grempt.
"Pandora is coming to you." "How can you know this?" Arjun asked. "Oh, truly, I want to believe it. I need her so very much. But how do you know?"
Grempt hesitated. He gestured for Arjun to speak.
"Tell me everything."
10 years ago, I sat on this veranda with Pandora, and we spoke," said Arjun. "I was still tired. I was not ready to join with her and her beloved friends. I told her I needed the sanctuary of the earth and what we learn in the earth, for we do learn when we sleep, as if an umbilical cord connects us to the living world above."
"That's true," said Grempt. "It was never my intention to wake now."
"Yes. But this voice... it spoke to me. I mean, it was in my mind at first, and it seemed these were my own thoughts, but in my sleep I did not embrace these thoughts."
"Yes."
"And then it had a tone and a vocabulary all its own, this voice, speaking to me in English sharply, telling me that I wanted to rise. I, Arjun, wanted to rise, to go into Mumbai and wipe them out, the young ones. It seemed so true to me, true. Why did I listen to this? I, who have never wanted trouble with my own kind, who stood my ground patiently centuries ago with Marius, telling him from my soul I would give up my maker to him if that's what he wanted, what she wanted. You understand? I fought my last battles when I was a mortal prince. What is this to me? Murdering, massacring, burning young ones?"
He hastened to answer his own question. "Is there something in the gentlest of us that longs to destroy? Something that dreams of annihilating other sentient beings?"
"Perhaps there is," said Grempt. "When did you realize that this was not what you wanted?" "When it was happening," confessed Arjun. "The buildings were in flames. They were screaming, bleeding with me, going down on their knees. And these were not all fledglings, you understand. Some of them had been in the blood hundreds of years. We survived the queen to perish like this? That's what they screamed as they put out their arms to me. What have we done to you? But it was only slowly coming clear to me what I had started. It became a battle. They're fighting me with the fire gift, and I overriding their weaker power. It was pleasurable.
Tears of shame rose in Arjun's eyes. He nodded.
Ah, you murder a human being, Arjun said, and you steal a life, yes, and that is unspeakable. You murder a blood drinker, and you steal eternity. You steal immortality.
He laid his head down on his arm. What happened in Kolkata?
That was not me, he said at once.
He sat back in the old rattan peacock chair, the broad woven back creaking against his weight.
I did not do it.
I believe you, said Grant.
But why did I kill these children in Mumbai?
The voice roused you for the purpose. It's done this in other places. It's done it in the Orient. It's doing it in South America. I've suspected from the beginning there was no one blood drinker enacting the burning.
But who is the voice? Asked Arjun.
Grimt grew quiet. Pandora is coming, he said. Arjun rose to his feet, almost upsetting the big chair behind him. He looked from right to left, trying to see through the darkness. When she emerged from the long, thick bamboo hedge, he went into her arms, and for a long moment they held one another, rocking back and forth. And then he broke the grip and covered her face with kisses. She stood very still, allowing this, a slender female with wavy brown hair wearing a long, simple, hooded cloak and robe, her pale white hands stroking Arjun's hair, her eyes closed as she savoured the moment. Excitedly he brought her towards the veranda and into the light coming from the rooms of the bungalow.
"Sit here, please, sit here,"
he said, bringing her to the teakwood table and the peacock chairs. Then, unable to stop himself, he embraced her again and sobbed silently against her shoulder. She whispered to him in the tongue they'd shared when she'd wooed and wed him. She consoled him with her kisses. Grimt had risen to his feet as any gentleman might in the presence of a woman. And this woman, Pandora, took his measure carefully, even as she suffered more kisses and embraces from Arjun. Her eyes were now fixed on him, and she was obviously listening to the beat of Gremt's heart, to the sound of his respiration as she studied his skin, his eyes, his hair. What did she see? A tall, blue-eyed male with short, black, wavy hair and Caucasian skin, and a face modelled on a Greek statue, a man with broad, capable shoulders and slender hands, dressed in a plain, long, black silk thob that covered him to his ankles, a garment that might have passed for a priest's cassock in another country. This was the body Grimt had perfected for himself over some 1,400 years. It might have fooled any human being on the planet. It could withstand the scrutiny of X-ray machines in modern airports, but it could not fool Pandora. It wasn't biologically human. She was shocked to the soul, but Grimt knew full well she'd seen beings like him before. Many times. Powerful beings walking around in made-up bodies, so to speak. Indeed, she'd seen Grimt many a time, though she had not always known that it was Grimt by any means. And the very first time he had ever seen her, he had been bodiless.
"I am your friend,"
Grimt said immediately, and he extended his hand to her, though she didn't lift her hand in response. Arjun was now wiping away his tears with an old linen handkerchief. Carefully he tucked this back into his pocket.
"I did not mean to do it," he said frantically.
He was imploring her to understand. And Pandora, as if wakened from a spell, turned her eyes away from Grimt and back to him.
"I knew you didn't," she said. "I understood this completely." "What must you think of me?"
he persisted, his face stricken with shame.
"Ah, but it wasn't you at all, was it?"
she said at once, taking his hand and then kissing him again and drawing back once more to look at Grimt.
"It was a voice, wasn't it?"
"Yes, a voice,"
he said.
"I was telling Grimt. Grimt understands. Grimt is a friend."
Very reluctantly she sat down as Arjun urged her to do so, and he settled back into his chair to the left of her. Only then did Gremt take his seat again.
"But you must have believed me guilty," Arjun said to Pandora, "or why else would you have come here to me?"
Pandora was again staring at Gremt. She was far too uncomfortable with the obvious mystery of Gremt to hear what Arjun wanted her to hear. Gremt turned to Arjun and spoke softly.
"Pandora knew because of the pictures, Arjun. When it happened, there were witnesses snapping pictures, and those pictures went viral, as they say, on the Internet. These pictures were infinitely more detailed and clear than telepathic glimpses. These pictures don't fade as memory fades. They will circulate for all time. And in New York, a young blood drinker named Benjamin Mahmoud, made by Marius, posted the pictures on a website. And Pandora saw those pictures."
"Ah, unspeakable disgrace," Arjun said,
covering his face with his long fingers.
"And so Marius and his children think I am guilty of this, and how many others believe it?"
"No, not so," said Pandora. "We're all coming to understand. Everyone is coming to understand."
"You must. You must know that it was the voice."
He looked helplessly to Gremt for confirmation.
"But Arjun is himself now," said Gremt, "and he is now perfectly capable of resisting the voice, and the voice has moved on to some other slumbering blood drinkers."
"Yes, that explains part of it," said Pandora, "but not all of it. Because it is now almost certain that the burnings happening in South America are being done by none other than Cayman."
"Cayman?" said Arjun. "Gentle Cayman? But I thought he had become the consort and guard of the twins now."
"That he is and has been for a long time," said Gremt.
"But Cayman has always been a broken soul, and he is now apparently as susceptible to the voice as some of the other old ones."
"And Maharet cannot control him?"
asked Pandora. There was an edge to her voice. She wanted to talk of all this, wanted to know what Gremt knew, but she wanted most certainly to know more about Gremt, so she spoke with a tone that said, "You are a stranger to me." She narrowed her eyes.
"Is Maharet herself the voice?" she asked with obvious horror.
Gremt said nothing.
"Could it be her twin, Makare?"
Still Gremt didn't answer.
"Unspeakable thought," whispered Arjun. "Well, who else could guide gentle Cayman to such things?"
Pandora murmured. She was thinking out loud. Again Gremt didn't answer.
"And if it is not one of those two," Pandora went on, "well then, who is it?"
she asked, as if she were a lawyer and Gremt were a hostile witness in a courtroom.
"It's far from clear," Gremt said finally. "But I think I know who it is. What I don't know is what it wants, what it means to do in the long run."
"And what is all this to you, precisely?"
Pandora demanded. Arjun was frightened by her tone, and he blinked as if she were a light blinding him with her coldness.
"What does it matter to you in particular?" she pressed. "What happens to us, creatures like us?"
Gremt pondered. Sooner or later he must reveal all. Sooner or later he must put forth all he knew. But was this the time for it? And how many times must he confess everything? He'd learned what he needed to learn here from Arjun, and he had comforted Arjun as had been his intention, and he had laid eyes on Pandora, to whom he owed an immense debt, but he was not sure he could answer her questions fully.
"You are dear to me," he said to her now, in a small but steady voice, "and it gives me a certain pleasure at last, after all these years, these centuries, to tell you that you are, and that you have always been, a shining star on my path, when you had no way of knowing it."
She was intrigued and mollified, but not satisfied. She waited. Her pale face, though she'd rubbed it with ashes and oil to make it less luminous tonight, looked virginal and biblical on account of her robes and the delicacy of her features. But behind that beautiful face she was calculating. How could she defend herself against a being like Gremt? Could she use her immense strength to harm him?
"No, you cannot,"
he said, giving her the answer. "It's time for me to leave you both." He rose to his feet.
"I urge you to go to New York, to join with Armand and Louis there."
"Why?"
she asked.
because you must come together to meet the challenge of the voice, just as you did long ago to meet the challenge of Akasha. You cannot allow this thing to continue. You must get to the root of the mystery, and that is best done if you come together. If you go there, Marius will follow your lead surely, and so will others, others whose names you do not know and have never known, and surely Lestat will come. And it is to Lestat that people look for leadership.
Oh, why to that insufferable brat? Murmured Arjun. What has he ever done but make trouble?
Gremt smiled. Pandora laughed softly under her breath as she glanced at Arjun, but then she fell silent again, thinking, gazing up at Gremt. She weighed all this calmly. Nothing he'd said shocked or surprised her.
And you, Gremt, why is it that you want the best for us? Asked Arjun.
He rose to his feet.
You have been so kind to me. You have comforted me. Why?
Gremt hesitated. He felt a knot loosened inside him.
I love you all,
he said in a low, confidential voice. He wondered if he looked cold to them as he spoke. He was never entirely sure how his emotions registered on this made-up human face, even when he could feel the blood in his veins rushing to his cheeks, feel the tears rising in his eyes. He never knew for sure if all these myriad systems that he so well controlled with his mind were truly working as he wanted them to work. To smile, to laugh, to yawn, to weep, this was nothing. But to truly register what he felt inside his own true, invisible heart, well, that was another matter.
You know me, he said to Pandora.
The tears were indeed rising in his eyes.
Oh, how I have loved you!
She sat in the peacock chair like a queen on a throne, gazing up at him, the soft black silk hood making a dark frame around her radiant face.
It was long, long ago, he said, on the coast of southern Italy, and a great man, a great scholar of those times, died on that night, in a beautiful monastery that he had built called Vivarium. Do you remember these things? Do you remember Vivarium? His name was Cassiodorus. And all the world remembers him, remembers his letters, his books, and most truly what he was, the scholar that he was in those days when darkness was closing over Italy.
His voice was rough now with his emotions. He could hear it breaking, but he went on, staring into her placid, unwavering gaze.
And you saw me then, saw me, a bodiless spirit, rise from the beehives in which I'd been slumbering, extended and rooted through a thousand tentacles in the bees, in their energy, in their collective and mysterious life. You saw me spring loose at that moment, and you saw me embrace with all my power the ludicrous figure of a straw man, a scarecrow, a thing of ridicule in a beggar's coat and pants, with an eyeless head and fingerless hands, and you saw me weep in that form, weep and mourn for the great Cassiodorus.
Red tears had risen in her eyes. She had written of this not long ago, but would she believe now that he was the one she'd seen? Would she remain silent?
I know you remember the words you spoke to me, he said. You were so very brave. You didn't flee from something you couldn't understand. You didn't turn away in disgust from something unnatural, even to you. You stood your ground and you spoke to me.
She nodded. She repeated the words she'd said to him that night.
If you would have fleshly life, human life, hard life which can move through time and space, then fight for it. If you would have human philosophy, then struggle and make yourself wise so that nothing can hurt you ever. Wisdom is strength. Collect yourself, whatever you are, into something with a purpose.
Yes, Gremt whispered.
And you said more. But know this, if you would become an organized being as you see in me, love all mankind and womankind and all their children. Do not take your strength from blood. Do not feed on suffering. Do not rise like a god above crowds chanting in adoration. Do not lie.
She nodded.
Yes, she said.
A gentle smile broke over her face. She was not failing him in this moment. She was opening to him. He saw the same sensitivity and compassion in her now that he had seen those many years ago, and he had waited so very long for this. He wanted to reach out to her, to embrace her, but he didn't dare.
"I have followed your counsel," he said.
Now he knew the tears were streaming from his eyes, though they never had before.
"I followed it always. And I built the Talamasca for you, Pandora, and for all of your kind, and for all humankind, and I patterned it as best I could on the monks and scholars of that beautiful old monastery, Vivarium, of which not a stone remains. I built it in memoriam to that brave Cassiodorus, who studied and dipped his pen to write to the very end, with such strength and devotion, even as the world went dark around him."
She sighed. She was amazed, and her smile brightened.
"And so it was from that moment?"
"Yes, that the Talamasca was born," he said. "From that encounter." Arjun was gazing at him in pure wonder. She rose from the table. She moved around it and came towards Gremt. How loving and eager she appeared, how guileless and how fearless. She was no more frightened of him now than she'd been hundreds of years ago. But he was spent, dangerously spent, more spent than he could ever have imagined by this, and he couldn't bear the sweetness, the joy of having her in his arms.
"Forgive me," he whispered.
He wiped foolishly at the tears on his face.
"Talk with us. Stay with us here," she said imploringly,
and Arjun uttered the same invitation. But Gremt did the only thing he could do with his waning strength. He moved away fast, leaving the garden behind him and the lights of the bungalow lost in the forest of bamboo and mango trees. She could have pursued him. If she did try to pursue, he would have no choice but to vanish, and that he did not want to do. He wanted to remain in this body as long as possible. That was always his choice. But she didn't pursue him. She accepted his exit, and he knew he'd see her soon again. He'd see them all soon, and he would tell her, and all of the others, everything. He followed the road for a long time, gradually regaining his strength, his body hardening once more, his pulse steady, the tears gone, and his vision clear. Headlights now and then picked him out of the darkness as cars swept by, leaving him once more in silence. So he had told her. He had confided the great secret of the Talamasca to her first of all, before all others, and very soon he would make it known to the entire tribe of blood-drinkers. Never to those mortal Talamasca members who struggled as they always did to continue their studies, no. They would be left in peace to continue with the fables of the Order's origins. But he would tell it to all of them, the great supernatural beings whom the Talamasca had studied from its very beginnings. And maybe they would understand, as she understood, and maybe they would accept, as she had accepted. And maybe they would not fail him in those moments of connection he so badly needed with them. Whatever the case, it was time, was it not, to help them directly, to reach out, to give them what he could as they confronted the greatest challenge in their history. Who better to help them solve the mystery of the voice than Gremt Stryker Knowles? 12.
Lestat. The Jungles of the Amazon.
David had drawn me out. Clever David. He'd called Benji's line in New York, chatting away with Benji on the broadcast about the crisis. He never gave his name. Didn't have to. Benji knew, and I knew, and probably a lot of other blood drinkers knew, that cultured British voice. On and on, David kept warning the young ones to stay out of the cities, to go into the countryside. He warned the old ones, who might be hearing some anonymous command to destroy others, don't listen. Benji kept agreeing. Over and over again, David said, stay out of cities like Lyon, or Berlin, or Florence, or Avignon, or Milan, or Avignon, or Rome, or Avignon, and so on it went, as he named city after city, always throwing in Avignon, and saying that he was certain the great hero Lestat was not the one guilty of all this.
He'd stake his eternal life on Lestat's honour, Lestat's loyalty to others, Lestat's innate sense of goodness. Why, he, David, wished he had the authority of the Pope, so that he could stand in the courtyard of the ruined Pope's palace at Avignon and declare for all the world that Lestat wasn't guilty of these burnings. I burst out laughing. I was listening, in my drawing room, in my father's chateau, not 400 kilometres from the little city of Avignon. There had never been any vampires in Avignon, and no burnings either. Every night I'd been listening to Benji. I was sick with worry for those who were dying. It was not all fledglings and the misbegotten. Many of the 300- and 400-year-old children of darkness were being slaughtered. Perhaps some of those I had known and loved on my long journey had been slaughtered, lost to me and to everyone else forever. When Akasha had gone on her rampage, her great burning, she'd spared those connected to me out of favour. But this new burning seemed infinitely more terrible, more random, and I could not guess any more than anyone else who or what lay behind the devastation. Where was my beloved Gabrielle? And how long would it be before this thing attacked the house of Armand and Louis in New York? I wondered, whoever and whatever it was, did it like listening to Benji's broadcasts? Did it like hearing of all the misery it was creating? "What do you think, voice?" I asked. No answer. The voice had long ago left me, hadn't it? The voice was behind this. Everyone knew that now, didn't they? The voice was rousing engines of murder from long slumber, urging them to use powers perhaps they'd never known they had. "These old ones are being roused by this voice," David said. "There's no doubt of this now. Witnesses have seen these old ones at the site of the massacres. So often it's a ragged figure, sometimes a hideous wraith. Surely it is the voice waking these people. Are not many of us hearing this voice?" "Who is the voice?" Benji demanded, over and over again. "Which of you out there has heard the voice? Call us, talk to us." David rang off. The surviving fledglings were taking over the airwaves. Benji had 20 phone lines now to receive those who were calling. Who staffed these lines? I didn't know enough about radio stations, phones, monitors, etc. to understand how it worked, but no mortal voice had ever been broadcast by Benji, not for any reason. And sometimes one mournful and miserable blood-drinker calling in would take an hour to unfold a tale of desperation. Did the other calls pile up? Whatever the case, I had to get to Avignon. David wanted me to meet him in Avignon, in the old ruined palace of the Popes. That was plain enough. Benji was now addressing the voice. "Call us here, voice," he was saying in that chipper, confident manner of his. "Tell us what you want. Why are you trying to destroy us?" I looked around my glorious digs here on the mountain, how I'd worked to reclaim this land of my father, how I'd worked to restore this chateau completely, and lately, with my own hands, I'd dug out secret rooms beneath it. How I loved these old stone-walled chambers where I'd grown up, now transformed with every sweet amenity, and the view from these windows of the mountains and fields where I'd hunted as a boy. Why? Why did I have to be drawn away from all this and into a battle I didn't want? Well, I wasn't going to reveal this place to David or anybody else, for that matter. If they didn't have the sense to look for me at Chateau de Liancourt in the Auvergne, that was their misfortune. After all, the place had been on all the maps. I put on my favourite red velvet jacket, slipped on my black boots and my usual sunglasses, and went to Avignon immediately. A lovely little city, Avignon, with winding cobblestone streets and countless cafés, and those old broken-down ruins where once the Roman Catholic pontiffs had reigned in splendour. And David was waiting for me, sure enough, along with Jesse, haunting the old ruin. Not a single other blood-drinker in the city. I came right down into the dark, grassy, high-walled courtyard. No mortal eyes to witness this. Just the dark, empty, broken archways in the stone cloister, gazing on like so many black eyes. "Brat Prince,"
David rose from his seat on the grass and threw his arms around me. "I see you're in fine form."
"Yeah, yeah, yeah," I mumbled. But it was so good to see him again, to see both of them. Jesse hovered against the old crumbling stone wall, wrapped in a heavy grey muffler. "Do we have to stand out here in this desolate place, under the shadow of all this history?" I said testily. But I didn't mean it. It was fine with me, this chilly September night, with deep winter already in the air. I was embarrassingly glad that they forced me to this meeting. "Of course not, Your Royal Highness," said David. "There's a fine little hotel in Lyon, the Villa Florentine, not far away at all. He's telling me I was born here, and we have comfortable rooms there." That sounded good enough. Within 15 minutes we'd made the little journey, and we entered the red-carpeted suite by the patio doors and were comfortably settled in the parlour. The hotel was above the town, on a hilltop with a pretty view, and I liked it just fine. Jessie looked worn and miserably unhappy, dressed in a creased and cracked brown leather jacket and pants, a grey wool sweater high under her chin, muffler covering her mouth, hair the usual shimmering veil of copper waves. David was in his grey worsted wool with a nappy suede vest and flashing silk tie, all bespoke, most likely. He was a good deal brighter in tone and expression than Jessie, but I knew the gravity of the situation. "Benji doesn't guess the half of it," Jessie said, the words just pouring out of her. "And I don't know what I can tell him or anyone else." She sat on the foot of the bed, hands clasped between her knees. "Maharet's banished me and Thorn forever. Forever!" She began to cry, but didn't stop talking. She explained that Thorn had been going and coming since the time Farid had restored his eyes to him, and he, the great Viking warrior, wanted to stand with Maharet against any force that threatened her. He'd heard the voice. He'd heard it in Sweden and Norway, prompting him to clean out the riffraff, speaking of a great purpose. He'd found it easy to shut out. "And you?" I asked, looking from Jessie to David. "Have either of you heard the voice?" Jessie shook her head no, but David nodded. "About a year ago, I started hearing it. About the most interesting words it ever uttered were in fact a question. It asked me whether or not we'd all been weakened by the proliferation of the power." "Remarkable," I said under my breath.
"What was your response?" "I told it no. I said I was as powerful as I'd ever been, perhaps a little more powerful of late."
"And did it say anything else?"
"It spoke mostly nonsense. Half the time I wasn't even sure it was speaking to me. I mean, it could have been addressing anyone. It spoke of an optimum number of blood drinkers, considering the source of the power. It spoke of the power as the sacred core. I could hear the capital letters. It raved that the realm of the undead was sunk now into depravity and madness. But it would go on and on around these ideas, often making little or no logical or sequential sense at all. It would even lapse into other languages, and it would, well, it would make mistakes. Mistakes in meaning, syntax. It was bizarre." Jessie was staring at him as if all this was a surprise to her. "To tell the truth," David explained, "I had no idea it was the voice, as people are saying now," said David. "I'm giving you the distilled version. It was mostly incoherent. I thought it was some old one. I mean, this happens, of course. Old ones shoot their messages to others. I found it tiresome. I tuned it out."
"And you, Jessie?" I asked.
"I've never heard it," she whispered. "I think that Thorn is the first to have spoken of it directly to me or Maharet."
"And what did she say?"
"She banished us both. She gave us infusions of her blood. She insisted on this, and then she told us we were not to come back. She'd already banished David." She glanced at him and then went on. "She said pretty much the same things to us she'd said to him. The time was past when she could extend hospitality any longer to others, that she and Makari and Cayman must now be alone."
"Cayman wasn't there at the time," David interjected. "Isn't that so?"
She nodded. "He'd been missing for a week at least," she went on with her story. "I begged her to let me remain. Thorn went down on his knees, but she was adamant. She said to leave then, not to wait on anything as cumbersome as regular transportation, but to take to the air and put as much distance between ourselves and her as we could.
I went to England immediately to see David. I think Thorne actually went to New York. I think many are going to New York. I think he went to Benji and Armand and Louis, but I'm not sure. Thorne was in a fury. He so loves Maharet. But she warned him not to try to deceive her. She said she'd know if he lingered. She was agitated, more agitated than I'd ever seen her. She pressed on me some routine information about resources, money, but I reminded her she'd seen to that. I knew how to get along out here.
The infusions of blood.